right, we're ready to go. Class 2.
So in our last class, looking at chapter 17, we saw Jehoshaphat really get off to a blazing start as he institutes tremendous religious education program in Judah at the beginning of his reign. And he was showing Judah by example what kind of a nation they needed to be, a nation who knew their God, who sought their God, a nation who appreciated the power of the Word in their life and in their nation. But then in chapter 18, we're introduced to an inherent flaw in Jehoshaphat's character. That while he's a man of good intentions and a man of good motives, unfortunately, too often he compromises God's standards and God's principles in his pursuit of friendship and harmony. And as we're going to see in this chapter, in chapter 18, Jehoshaphat's foolish alliance that he makes with King Ahab of Israel in this chapter, well, it almost kills him. And worse than that, it lays the foundation for a series of events that almost leads to the extinguishing of the royal Davidic line in Judah. That's one of the mistakes we talked about in the first class that had long-lasting effects. And it all starts with a wedding in verse 1. A marriage between Jehoshaphat's son Jehoram and Ahab and Jezebel's daughter Athaliah. We all know the character of these three individuals, so it's really quite shocking that Jehoshaphat didn't identify this as a bad mix. And it looks like Jehoshaphat is the one who initiated this marriage union. Now, King Ahab is memorialized as one of the most wicked kings to reign over Israel and Judah. And Jezebel, well, we know Jezebel as the woman who instituted the first systematic persecution of God's people so that the prophets and priests of God had to be hid in caves. We know that she prompted Ahab to bring about the murder of Naboth. And if we were to look at Revelation, which we're not going to, Jezebel becomes a symbol of false religion and the false church. So this is definitely not a spiritual family that Jehoshaphat is getting his son involved in. Now, joined affinity, it says in the Authorized Version, and I think it says in whatever Bobby read, and also in the New King James, it says, made an alliance through marriage. It means to contract affinity by marriage, usually by the marriage of a daughter. Now, you can see it's the same word used in 1 Kings chapter 3, speaking of Solomon, how Solomon made affinity with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. Now, the first part of that verse there, Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance. So he's been blessed with peace and prosperity. He's dealt with a spiritual deficit in Judah, and he looks north across the border, and he sees that state of Israel that we looked at. He sees all sorts of problems. And God's working with Elijah, God's working with Obadiah, God's working with the school of the prophets, and Jehoshaphat wants to help too. Remember, he's a man of good motives. So, just 60 years ago, previous to Jehoshaphat reigning, the nation of Israel had been one nation before it was divided at the time of Jeroboam and Rehoboam. So Jehoshaphat really seems to want to reunite that break between the northern and the southern kingdom. So what can he do? How can he help solve Israel's spiritual problems? Well, he has riches, but he can't buy them spirituality. But he has a son who has been raised in Jehoshaphat's environment. And what if he can, by marriage, try and put a spiritual person on the throne in Israel, try and influence the policies of the nation with his son? So what does he do? In order to potentially, bring Athaliah over to spiritual ways, he marries his son to her. With good intentions, he gives his 15-year-old son, potentially 14 years old, and he marries him to Athaliah, Jezebel's daughter. Now, is there anyone who's 15 here? Yeah, a couple people over there who are 15. Now, could you imagine being married and having Jezebel as a mother-in-law? And think of the environment that it would be like in that situation. And Ahab as a father-in-law. Well, it's really a recipe for disaster, isn't it? Because if you look at the character of Athaliah, well, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And Athaliah is seems almost as bad as Jezebel. And you know, it's not surprising, is it, that Jehoram eventually becomes one of them. Look over at 2 Chronicles chapter 21. 2 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 6. Well, verse 5. Jehoram was 32 years old when he began to reign, and reigned 8 years in Jerusalem, and he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. Like as did the house of Ahab. So he didn't take after Jehoshaphat, he took after Ahab. For he had the daughter of Ahab to wife, and he wrought that which was evil in the ways of the Lord. Now none of you, I don't think, in the first 10 rows anyway, have to worry about your children being married to Athaliah. But you do have to worry about yourself. And the consistent counsel of Scripture from cover to cover is this is where you're going to look for a partner. Because even when the intentions are good, as we're going to see with Jehoram and Athaliah, all too often the truth ends up getting compromised when we look outside God's borders, and sometimes it's completely lost. So we just have a chart up here, which is interesting. If you look at the verse at the top, his wives turned away his heart. That's what happened when Solomon married all those wives. If you look at the history of the truth in the Bible, all the times when the truth began to get lost was preceded by a time of a really casual attitude to relationships with those who were enemies of God. So, the time of the flood, Genesis chapter 6. The sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took of them every one according to whom they chose. It was their choosing and not God. The time of the Exodus. We think of the whoredoms committed between the children of Israel and the Midianitish, the Moabitish women after Balaam prompted them. The time of the judges. Elimelech's sons, we mentioned that last night. Mahlon and Chilion going down into Moab. The Samson and the Philistines. And if you look at Judges chapter 1 and 2, there's countless examples in those chapters of the inter-involvement. Well, the time of the kings. Well, you have Solomon and his wives. Think of Ahab and Jezebel, Jehoram and Athaliah. The time of the exile. And the people came back from Babylon. And what happened? Well, intermarriage to the point that the children, it says, they didn't speak Hebrew. What does that mean, spiritually speaking? The children didn't speak the language of the truth. And then there's warnings in the first century. So we want to do a little demonstration, hopefully this to get the point of this, of Jehoram and Athaliah syndrome. Okay? When we, like Jehoshaphat did, sometimes overestimate our own spiritual strength and get ourselves involved in situations where with someone who's not committed. So I need two volunteers. And the strapping young lad in the third row. And young lady. No volunteers. I'll have to start picking. Ruth, come on up. You don't want to? Okay. All right. Well, we have to come up here. Come up here. And I hope you can stand on this. Oh, dear. You're standing. You're going to stand on here. You're going to represent lifted up in the ways of the Lord, okay? And I would like... Oh, no, no. No, wrong way. You are going to represent lifted up in the ways of the Lord. Sorry about that. And I would like you to try to pull her up onto that chair. Go, keep trying. Okay. Okay, that's good. That's a good try. Can you try to pull him down? Yes. Good. He did his best. He's like a cat, but still. So it was much easier. You can see for Ruth to pull Eric off the chair than for her to pull him up. Or the other way around. Now, can you? Ruth, I'm going to get you to wear this backpack. Okay?
And it has strong concordance and a couple copies of Eureka in it, so it's very weighty. Now, I'd like to try and pull her up again. And you'll notice that on the backpack, what is this? Can you show everyone's model of the backpack? Attraction and emotion. Okay? See what happens. Let's do it the other way again. Okay. Thank you very much for that, for helping. So what's the lesson?
Well, and you can both have a seat. Thank you.
Well, it's much easier to be pulled down from spiritual heights and pulled away than it is to try and manhandle someone into that, up to that spiritual height, especially when you put emotion and physical attraction in there, which is really good things to cloud our judgment and to alter our spiritual perception. Now, when I think of my own Sunday school and CYC that I grew up in, a fairly healthy-sized class, well, there's only two of us that are still in the truth. And all the rest of my Sunday school class that has either left the truth or didn't come in, left because of either relationships with the world, whether it was boyfriend-girlfriend, whether it was just friendships, whatever it was, they developed relationships flirting with the world, and the world wouldn't let them go. And I haven't seen a lot of those people in 20 years or so as a result. So when we develop affinity with those who are pulling us in the wrong direction, well, chances are we're going to get turned in that direction, or as Solomon says, we can get burned. He says, can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? It's a very dangerous thing, isn't it? Now let's look at 2 Corinthians 6:14, which you probably looked at many times, but we want to look at one of the little phrases there from a slightly, well, from the same angle, but just look at it a little more deeply. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14. Second Corinthians 6:14-15. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? What communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Well, does anyone know what that... Well, you have the notes, of course you know. The word concord there is the Greek word symphonesis, from which we get the word symphony. Okay? It means to be harmonious or to sound alike. Now, who here has heard an orchestra playing? Everybody has it in some form. And hearing an orchestra, hearing a symphony play, well, it's a united, harmonious, beautiful sound created by a group of people reading the same music and following the same conductor. And does anyone know what the opposite of symphony is? Cacophony. Oh, he got it right off. Cacophony, okay? It's the idea of discord, bad noise, doesn't sound nice. That's the opposite of symphony. Thanks, Andrew. So we're going to do another little object lesson here, which is hopefully get the effect across. And we have two lovely assistants who are going to play us two songs. One of the assistants is lovely. Anyway, you guys can decide which one. They're going to play two songs on a piano, on two pianos. Work your way over there. Don't actually look at the music because I don't want you to see what hymn they're playing, okay? So when they play, I just want you to close your eyes and see if you can figure out what are the two tunes, the two hymns that they're playing. And then I want you to tell me if you think it was pleasant sound, okay? So Tim has to get his piano set up all the right settings. You good to go? I'm not going to count them in. I don't want to give you any hints, so just close your eyes and just listen. And ready, go!
Okay, thank you. It's supposed to be on piano and on organ, but that works all the way. Okay, thank you for the one lovely assistant and the other person who played the other piano. So, could anybody tell what either of those hymns were? We put the pianos together so you wouldn't be able to differentiate on either side, but was anybody able to recognize that? No? Did this sound pleasant to anybody? To some people? Oh dear, we have some work tonight for our music class. So the lesson is, if we're not playing from the same music, this is our music, or following the same conductor, then we have trouble making beautiful noise, don't we? Really interesting. Look over at Ephesians chapter 5. Seeing as we're just a few pages away. Now, Ephesians chapter 5, verse 19, and Colossians chapter 3, verse 16 are probably two of the most well-known verses about music in the Bible, especially in the New Testament. It's really interesting, is having looked at this idea of unequal yoking is cacophony, it's not symphony. This, in the context of this, Ephesians 5 is the marriage chapter about equal yoking. Well, it's talking about, it's in the context of music, okay? So look at verses 19 and 22. Ephesians 5, verse 19. Speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. Wives, submit yourselves unto your husbands as unto the Lord, and husband, love your wives even as Christ loved the Ecclesia. And Colossians 3, verse 16 says the exact same thing, and it's also in the Colossians chapter on marriage. So you get this idea that equal yoking is beautiful, sweet music to God. Now, Athaliah was technically a member of the Samaria Ecclesia, wasn't she? Even then, we need to use spiritual discernment and use our minds when we're looking for this idea of spiritual companionship. Now, in your notes, you're going to find two pages somewhere, and I think it's after this class, of verses and principles related to courtship and marriage. We're not going to go into it anymore. I did compile the notes and everything, but they are actually by a much older, wiser brother than myself. And I think it's really good on our own time to look at these things through so we can see the consistent message from Genesis to Revelation and get a good feel for what God's expecting from us. Now, let's look at chapter 18, verse 2. Go back to 2 Chronicles. We're going to turn back to the fruits of this alliance. And again, as we said, Jehoshaphat making some silly, silly mistakes in this chapter. So 2 Chronicles chapter 18, verse 2. And after certain years, and it's about 10 years, Jehoshaphat went down to Ahab to Samaria. Now, if we had a map, we could show that Samaria is actually north of Jerusalem. So Jehoshaphat should be going up. It should be saying it's going up to Samaria, but really, spiritually, he's going down. He's going down to Ahab's city. He's going down to work on Ahab's terms. And look what Ahab does. Ahab knows Jehoshaphat is a spiritual man, so he tries to play to Jehoshaphat's spirituality. He's trying to fool him that, yes, he is a religious man, half religious. So what does he do? He kills sheep and oxen for him in abundance. He offers sacrifices. He's creating a spiritual environment. And for the people that Jehoshaphat with him, and he persuaded him to go up with him to Ramoth Gilead. And Ahab, king of Israel, said unto Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, wilt thou go with me to Ramoth Gilead? And Jehoshaphat answered him, I am as thou art, and my people as thy people, and we will be with thee in the war. Now, the first time I read this chapter, or started looking into this, I was just blown away that Jehoshaphat would say those four words. I am, those five words. I am as thou art. To Ahab. These men are diametrically opposed, aren't they? And he says, I am as thou art. Now, what do these men have in common? Now, does anyone recognize these phrases that Jehoshaphat says? He says, go with me. I am as thou art. My people as thy people. We will be with thee. Does that ring any bells in anybody's mind? Similar language used elsewhere.
Ruth and Naomi. Turn back to Ruth chapter 1. Now you'll remember that in Ruth chapter 1, during the time of the judges, Elimelech took his wife Naomi and their sons Mahlon and Chilion out of Israel to Moab, and Elimelech and his sons die there. Now when Ruth and Naomi come back, Ruth turns her back on Moab and pledges her allegiance to the God of Israel. And look what she says, Ruth chapter 1, verse 16. Ruth says, "Entreat me not to leave thee or return from following after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go. Whither thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God." And then where she dies, there Ruth wants to be buried as well. So this was Ruth's confession of faith. This was an oath before God. And then Jehoshaphat picks up on that language. He's quoting Ruth, and he's applying this verse to his relationship with Ahab. So he's definitely not thinking along spiritual terms. He's quoting the spiritual confession of faith of Ruth and using it and saying, "I'm united with you, Ahab." And it's quite ridiculous, isn't it? Now, I don't think we'll have time. So on your own time, look at Deuteronomy. I think it's in your notes anyway. Deuteronomy 13, verses 6 to 9. That's actually the first occurrence of that word in verse 2, is it? Where it says, Jehoshaphat, or Ahab persuaded Jehoshaphat to go with him. And, verse 2. That word persuaded, the first time it's used is in Deuteronomy 13. And it's translated as enticed. And the context is, you can see, family members enticing you to go serve other gods, which is largely what Ahab is doing with Jehoshaphat. It's the family in-law, and he's saying, "Let's, you know, work on my terms." And what are they supposed to do in verse 8? "Thou shalt not consent unto him, but thou shalt surely kill him." So you definitely see God's perspective on how you're supposed to respond to this. And Ahab entices Jehoshaphat, and he says, "Sure, we're the same." So that's as much as we're going to say about that right now, but definitely an interesting passage. Now, in chapter 18, verse 4, you can see Jehoshaphat is kind of uncomfortable with the situation as it is. So he says in verse 4 of 2 Chronicles 20, "Inquire, I pray thee, Ahab, at the word of Yahweh today." But he gets things way out of order, doesn't he? He initiates an alliance with Ahab. Then he agrees to go to war as one with him. But then he says, maybe we should ask God in prayer what to do. But he's already made all these steps. And you know that word in verse 4? Jehoshaphat said unto the king of Israel, "Inquire, I pray thee." Well, that's the word Derash. That's our seeking word again, where Jehoshaphat was going to seek the ways of the Lord. He's saying to Ahab, "Let's seek God." Well, he's in the wrong place if he wants a seeker of God, isn't he? But Ahab kind of capitulates. He kind of goes along with Jehoshaphat. And look at verse 5. "Therefore, because of this request, the king of Israel gathered together of prophets 400 men, and these would be the 400 prophets of the grove who are left over after the battle on Mount Carmel, when the 450 prophets of Baal were slain after God sent down fire. There's 400 prophets of the grove that are left over. And so Ahab calls, "Okay, yeah, we'll call on Yahweh. I'll bring Jezebel's personal prophets of the grove, all 400 of them. That's good enough." And he asks these prophets, "Shall we go to Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear?" And the prophet said, "Go up, for God will deliver it into the king's hand." But Jehoshaphat kind of whispers to him, "Isn't there a prophet of Yahweh here that we might inquire of him?" Now, Ahab has completely lost the difference between truth and error, hasn't he? Jehoshaphat says, "Let's inquire from God, from Yahweh, from the Lord." And Ahab brings in 400 prophets of the grove, chanting ritualistic pagan priests, because he thinks that's the same. You've got to think that right about now, Jehoshaphat is thinking, what am I getting myself into? There's not a single prophet of God that they can call. And there's still time for him to back out of this foolish alliance, but he folds under the pressure. We're going to see that he doesn't gain enough courage to do what's right until it's too late. So the king says in verse 7, yes, there is one man by whom we may inquire of Yahweh. Think about that, how all the prophets had to be hid, and how Elisha was fearful of going to see Ahab and Jezebel because he was going to be killed too. So there's one that they know of. There is one man by whom we may inquire of Yahweh, but I hate him, for he never prophesied good unto me, but always evil. The same is Micaiah, the son of Imlah. And Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say so. The reason Ahab hates Micaiah is that he never speaks good. He never tells me I'm doing the right thing. He never approves of my wickedness, so I hate him. It kind of gives you the kind of a feel for what kind of a man Ahab is. He doesn't want to hear what's right or true. He wants to hear what's convenient. So nevertheless, in verse 8, the king of Israel called for one of his officers and said, fetch quickly Micaiah the son of Imlah. And the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat king of Judah sat either of them on his throne, clothed in their robes, and they sat in a void place at the entering in of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets prophesied before them. So, in verse 9, two kings sitting on their throne together. Now, does anyone know what sitting represents in the Bible, when people sit together? I was going to say, starts with an F and ends in ship. Yeah, fellowship. If you think back to Psalm 1, verse 1, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. Sitting is the end. It's when you've declared union and fellowship. So Jehoshaphat, well, he's fulfilling Psalm 1, verse 1. Blessed is the man who does not sit in the seat of the scornful. Well, Ahab is the perfect definition of a scorner of God. Jehoshaphat is sitting, having fellowship, claiming oneness with a scorner of God. So, Zedekiah, the leader of these prophets of the grove, he comes in verse 10, and he prophesies, he makes something up, and he says, thus saith the Lord, with these horns thou shalt push Syria until they be consumed. And all the prophets prophesied so, saying, go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for Yahweh shall deliver it into the hand of the king. And think back to Elijah on Mount Carmel for a second, and think to how these kind of prophets prophesied and how they behaved. What do we remember about that situation? What did the priests do from morning till evening? They chanted, they ran around the altar, they jumped on the altar, they cut themselves. This is kind of what's happening in front of Jehoshaphat as he's sitting there. So this is 400 men chanting over and over, go up to Ramoth-Gilead, go up, go up, go up. And this is not what Jehoshaphat's used to. This is more like a pagan ritual sacrifice going on. And to Ahab, this represents God. This represents what God is saying. So while they're saying this, the messenger goes out and he gets Micaiah the prophet and he brings him in. And then he says to him in verse 11, the messenger that went to call Micaiah spake to him, saying, and you can just hear the threat in these words that he says. He says, behold, the words of the prophets declare good to the king with one assent. Let thy word, therefore, I pray thee, be like one of theirs, and speak thou good. He's threatening. He's saying, we don't want you to disagree. We've got 400 people agreeing. You'd be smart to say the exact same thing. But then look what Micaiah says. I think it's one of the most profound little phrases from the study of Jehoshaphat. He says, as Yahweh liveth, even what my God says, that will I speak. And it's often hard to make the stand that Micaiah makes, isn't it? When we're young, when we're not so young, is difficult. Maybe it's at school. Maybe it's at work. Maybe even sometimes it's at CYC. And the conversation starts drifting somewhere that it shouldn't. You know you should say something. You know it's not right. But it's tricky. There's pressure. There might not be 400 chanting prophets of the grove there, but it doesn't make it easy. And at times like that, when we need to think of Micaiah, just one man, facing 400 prophets of the grove, facing two kings, sitting right there, and they all want him to say one thing, and he says, I'll tell you what God has to say, and I'm not worried about what you want to hear. And it would be so tempting for him to change his message, wouldn't it? To think, good grief, this is a bad situation. If I tell them what they want to hear, they're probably going to let me go. But he doesn't change his message. He stands up for what is right, no matter the consequence. And you know what? I think this is the example that Jehoshaphat needed. Not just us, but Jehoshaphat needed right now. Someone who's making a stand for what it is right, for what is right, without compromising the truth. And how do you think Jehoshaphat would have felt when Micaiah says, even what my God says, that's what I'm going to speak? He didn't say, our God, Jehoshaphat. You're not acting like Yahweh is your God. It's my God. And you can imagine that Jehoshaphat is squirming and sweating. He realizes that Micaiah is the better man. He realizes that he should be standing beside Micaiah and not sitting beside Ahab the scorner, because he's on the side of the prophets of the grove. So it's a good prick of the conscience for Jehoshaphat as well as us. Now there's a lot of verses in the chapter and a long way to go, so we're going to just kind of fly through this. Verse 14. And when he was come to the king said to Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And Micaiah gives him a sarcastic response. Get up and prosper, and they shall be delivered into your hand. And King Ahab says to him, how many times shall I adjure thee that thou say nothing but the truth to me in the name of Yahweh? And I don't think Ahab is taking himself seriously right now. He knows he doesn't want to hear what's true. But Micaiah says in verse 16, you want to hear the truth? Well, here's the truth. Micaiah gives him the truth in verse 16 and says, I did see all Israel scattered upon the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master. Let them return, therefore, every man to his house in peace. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell thee that he would not prophesy good unto me, but evil? Now the next section from verse 18 to 22, we want to read through. It's interesting. It's a little hard to follow, but it gives us a glimpse into how the court of heaven works. So let's try and follow this. 2 Chronicles 18, verse 18 to 22. And again, Micaiah continues, and he says, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting upon his throne, and all the host of heaven standing on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, who shall entice Ahab, king of Israel, that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one spake saying after this manner, and another saying after that manner. Then there came out a spirit and stood before Yahweh and said, I will entice him. And Yahweh said unto him, wherewith? How are you going to do it? And the spirit says, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And Yahweh says, thou shalt entice him, and thou shalt also prevail. Go out and do even so. Then Micaiah says, now therefore, in this manner, the Lord hath put a lying spirit in the mouth of these thy prophets, and the Lord hath spoken evil against thee. Or as the New American Standard Bible says, God has proclaimed disaster against you. Now that part, particularly in verses 20 and 21, is a little bit tricky to understand, I think. And in terms of how we view the angels of God, we can sometimes consider them or view them as robots. They're programmed to do God's will blindly. But passages like this one suggest that although God's work cannot fail, he does allow the angels, his ministers, the messengers who outwork that will, to show their own creativity or initiative in working out God's desired end. Now, in this particular situation, God has decreed Ahab needs to die in Ramoth-Gilead. It cannot fail. It's going to happen. And who's going to make it happen? The angels. They're going to make it happen. They are God's fingers. They're God's eyes who work out God's will. Well, but how exactly is it happen? How is Ahab going to die in Ramoth-Gilead? Well, in verse 19 to 20, there's this picture of the angels discussing different options and ideas all under the jurisdiction of God's will. And then one angel comes forward and presents his suggestion. God gives his approval and sends this angel or this spirit out to be a lying spirit in the mouth of Ahab's prophets. Now, first you may think that sounds kind of weird and think, well, angels don't tell lies, though. Angels can't sin. They do God's will. Very true. But angels can, and the angels do use those characteristics if they already exist in mankind. So the angel says, I will make sure that the prophets of Baal tell the lies that Ahab wants to hear that will drive him into the position that he needs to be in. And really, it's a perfect way for Ahab to meet his demise, because Ahab was a man who lived on lies. He paid his prophets to tell lies because he prefers lies to the truth. He hated Micaiah because Micaiah wouldn't tell lies. Micaiah said, I will only tell you what God has to say. Ahab hated that. He did not want to hear truth. And think about Jezebel. We have a verse on the screen. And how Jezebel, his wife, used lying and deceit and false witnesses to bring about the death of faithful Naboth, right? Jezebel set two men, sons of Eliah, to bear false witness against Naboth. So the angels knew that Ahab had surrounded himself with people whose sole purpose was to deceive and to lie. So using a lying spirit to bring about Ahab's end, well, that was perfect. It was poetic justice, wasn't it? Ahab's already choosing that kind of environment for himself. So the lying spirit of Ahab's life is going to lead to his destruction. And the lesson, I think, of this is that God won't necessarily stop us if we're intent on following our own path or intent on following sin. In fact, he might just let those sins or use those very sins to bring about our destruction. Romans 1 tells us that. Romans 1, verse 24. Ezekiel 14 tells us that. And 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 tells us that as well. Let's go over to 2 Thessalonians 2. Now in 2 Thessalonians 2, as you're probably aware, the Apostle Paul is warning the Thessalonian believers of a false religious system, the spirit of Antichrist, which was already at work amongst them. And he says, this system is going to thrive on lying and deceiving people. And Paul says, in this passage we're going to look at, that because people aren't interested in hearing the truth, they don't want the truth, they want a lie, then God is going to allow the spirit of deception to deceive them. So starting in verse 9, 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 9, Paul speaks of the man of sin whose coming is after the working of Satan with all powers and signs and lying wonders. And this is the system which Jezebel becomes representative of in Revelation. So Ahab and Jezebel, all throughout Scripture, are a symbol of false religion and deception. So, there's power and signs and lying wonders with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this cause, God shall send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie. God is putting this lie in front of them because they have already shown, as the verse says, they receive not the love of the truth that they might be saved. So there's no love of truth. As I said, Ezekiel and Romans say the same thing. So I think we're being told that we can choose the path of our own destruction. If we surround ourselves in sin or a certain type of sin, God could use that to teach us a lesson, or in the case of Ahab, to bring about his destruction. So Ahab had created an environment, a life of lies and deceit. Well, that was the avenue that God was going to take him down, because that's the avenue Ahab was already traveling on. Now, there's a stark contrast in that little prophecy by Micaiah between Ahab's hall and the heavenly court. Both of them were their own leader, with their own throne, with their own messengers, and their own spirit. I think Micaiah is really drawing everybody's attention to how different Ahab's court was to how God ran his court. So in verse 9, you have reference to Jehoshaphat and Ahab sitting either of them on his throne. And then verse 18, Micaiah speaks of God sitting on his throne. In verse 9, all the prophets prophesied before Ahab. Verse 18, all the host of heaven is on God's right hand and on his left hand, all prophesying or speaking to God. And then Ahab sends a messenger, and the word messenger, as we know, is Malachi. It means angel. So Ahab sends a human messenger to get Micaiah, and in verse 18, God ends up sending out a divine messenger, a divine Malach, an angel, to do his will. So, is this class supposed to end at 3:30? Yes? Yes? Okay. We'll try for 3:35. We're almost done. Verses 22 to 26 back in 2 Chronicles chapter 18. Suffice it to say, Ahab is not pleased with the response that Micaiah gives when Micaiah says, you're going to die, and Israel is going to be scattered. So he slaps him across the cheek, sends him to prison. And as he does this, in verse 26 he says, feed him with bread of affliction and water of affliction until I return in peace. Verse 27, Micaiah says, if thou certainly return in peace, then the Lord hath not spoken by me. And he said, hearken, all ye people. Or as the king's account says, hearken, O people, every one of you. And that would include Jehoshaphat, wouldn't it, in that warning. And that's the last we ever hear of Micaiah. His voice echoes out of that hall, and he's dragged off into prison. And I think the prick of Jehoshaphat's conscience is extra sharp, because you'll remember that one of the last things that his father Asa did before he went on a spiritual nosedive is what? He put the prophet who spoke uncomfortable words of truth in prison, just like Ahab did. Go back to chapter 16. It's really quick, just to remind you. Chapter 16 and verse 10. Asa was wroth with the seer and put him in a prison house, because he was in a rage with him because of this thing. So, Hanani the seer spoke words of truth, he gets put in prison by Asa. Micaiah speaks words of truth, he gets put in prison by Ahab. And Jehoshaphat is sitting there, and this is all coming to his mind. And he's sitting there, dressed up in his finery, sitting on the throne, while Micaiah takes the hard road. And that's the road Jehoshaphat should have taken. Well, to summarize what happens, everything that Micaiah predicted comes true. The Syrians are victorious, Ahab is dead, and Israel is scattered like sheep without a shepherd. And look at verse 31, just as we kind of wrap things up. Chapter 18, verse 31. And it came to pass, when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat, that they said, it's the king of Israel. They compassed about him to fight, and Jehoshaphat cried out, and Yahweh helped him, and God moved them to depart from him. Now, sometimes we can put ourselves in a situation like Jehoshaphat, where we ignore all the signs that God has, we have an end in mind, and we move forward without consulting God, without consulting the elders, without consulting our parents. And we can get into some pretty sticky situations, just like Jehoshaphat. And we can be thankful, along with Jehoshaphat, that God can save us. He can reach in and grab us out of these silly mistakes that we make. But we need to learn from our mistakes. And that's what Jehoshaphat does in chapter 19. He breaks off this link and this alliance with Ahab. He comes back and he sets about focusing on Judah and making sure that they're brought up spiritually, lifted up in the ways of the Lord again. So, really quickly, let's just go through spiritual principles in chapter 18. As we saw, contrasting Jehoram and Athaliah, relationships and marriage need to be built on unity of mind within God's parameters, symphony, not, as Andrew said, cacophony. I didn't think anyone would know that word. That's good for you. Prayer needs to come before spiritual important decisions, not afterwards like Jehoshaphat. God won't force us to change the direction of our life, and it could eventually be the way that He uses to judge us. We need to take the lesson of Micaiah to speak the truth regardless of any and all consequences, even if it means being sent to prison. And we take comfort in the fact that God can rescue us from our blunders if our heart is true and our cries are sincere and our hearts are lifted up and if we are seeking Him. And we're going to see in our next class that Jehoshaphat certainly does make up for the mistakes that he made in this one.